scowling.
I'm not trying to do that.
What?
That's too funny.
I'm taking over. Members, I want to announce a coup. It was so fun doing this last time that now we've holding Epson Gotwell hostage, and yes, the takeover is complete. Anyway, Epson Gotwell's detained somewhere. Epson Mac has been kidnapped, and so you have to have me for a while. This is another special day. This is Leap Year Day. It's also the show epic day here. Repton Schumacher has every bill on the calendar, on the agenda for today, so I think it's a big day for the Schumacher family. Representative Schumacher, if you want to take your chair there that you're going to own for the balance of the session.
It is a big day, Mr. Chair. My mom is very excited to be watching this online today, so shout out to her, I guess.
Hello, Mrs. Schumacher. Maybe we could... So welcome to the committee. If you want to move House File 18... Oh, we can't. Oh, so we haven't got a quorum yet, so we'll just discuss it, and then when we'll come to order, and we'll move the bill to go to finance, I believe. So.
Right. And there is an A1 amendment to that bill as well. That came from the department there. The A1 amendment, I'll just speak to that briefly, too, so that we're on the same page with this. The amendment comes at the recommendation of the Department of Human Services and basically governs the probation officers and correction officials in notifying DHS when an individual has been affiliated with their program within the preceding year. And that's okay. The crux of that amendment.
I just thought I sensed a Kerber in the room, and there he is. So do you have testifiers to this?
Not to the amendment, no.
Okay. Well, we can't move anything yet, so why don't you tell us about your bill?
All right.
And then we'll probably hear from Mr. Kerber, just since it is epic leap year day and your day. So, right. So does that sound good to you?
That sounds great, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So tell us about House File 1985, please.
All right. Well, House File 1985 modifies the requirements for background checks at licensed facilities. Currently, an employee who returns to a position after 45 days or longer is required to have another background study issued, and this bill lengthens that 45-day threshold to 180 days. The lengthening of the time period before another study is conducted is intended to help particular groups, mothers that are returning to the workforce after maternity leave, college students wanting to work during school breaks like Thanksgiving or the winter holiday, and preschool employees who are not employed during the summer months. A $20 fee is currently assessed with each study. It's my understanding, though, that currently DHS has been waiving the study fee at this time. The department does estimate that about 1,500 studies were performed last year due to the 45-day period, and this bill would reduce the number of repeat studies down to 500. The 180 days basically establishes a window to cover those groups that we talked about before, and this issue came to my attention through a human resource director at a nursing home from my district. She had shared some concerns with me about this because she currently is required to report anything that would remove an employee's good standing, and the groups most likely to be impacted are the mothers on maternity leave and college students who are returning from break. And so this bill is inspired by one of my constituents back home. And with that, I'll yield for any other testimony then.
So this bill is good for mothers and students, pretty much. And so if you like mothers and students, then you'd be for the bill, pretty much. I got it. Okay.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, just a minute. We have a quorum, so you can actually have official comments. Yeah. And actually, Representative Schumacher, why don't you move? Oh, that's right. Okay. I will move House File 1985 to be re-referred to the Finance Committee. And we put the amendment on, and so it gets in the order you want to do that. I'll move the A1 amendment. Does everybody understand that amendment? Okay, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Almost nobody voted. anybody opposed? That's adopted. The bill is now in order that you'd like to discuss it, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Roseland, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. We represent licensed child care centers throughout Minnesota. Some of the ones that might come to mind include KinderCare, Tutor Time, New Horizons Academy, and such. Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for introducing this bill. He actually said everything I was going to say for the very reasons. We support the bill for the very reasons. The background study requirement has affected our employees because many might be on maternity leave or are college students, such as that. So I'm not going to waste the committee's time other than to just let you know we strongly support this bill, and thanks for bringing it forward.
Ms. Dolesland, the 180 days I know solves a lot of your problems. Does a shorter time help as well, or do you think that a year is better? Do you have an opinion about that?
We were surprised at the 180 days. We were pleased at the 180 days. I'd have to think about what the impact of a year would be.
How about a shorter time? Would 90 days help you, or 180 days, or is 180
120 would be probably be the minimum. That 90 days, I think, would be that's 3 months. Especially as Representative Schoenmaker mentioned, maybe the school-based preschool programs or other programs that might the 90 day might be too short. So I think 120 would be the minimum that we would support.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for the witness? Okay. Thank you. And who's Ms. Thompson? Oh, hi. Welcome to the committee on this epic day.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a very hectic day, and thank you for your patience.
So tell us your name and what you have to say.
My name is Lisa Thompson. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to come here today to testify in support of House File 1985. And thank you to the representative for bringing forth this bill. I've been a family child care provider for 18 years in St. Paul. And for the first 12 years, I rarely, if ever, left my kids in the care of anyone else. Now, this was mostly out of necessity rather than design, because it's very difficult to find an approved, qualified, and albeit willing substitute. But this is the nature, and this is by nature, not the kind of business that lends itself to having employees as well. Family child care is primarily a one-woman show. But it's a great career, and I really do love the work. But it also means that for most of us, having someone else fill in is not even on the radar. We do, however, need to have a person on file who could come in the event of an emergency. So each time we go through the relicensing process, we designate someone who we know is willing and able, and a background study is completed for this person. Now each time we renew our license, the background checks are repeated for everyone. Now over the past 18 years, I've only had one situation where I needed to use an emergency contact. So you can imagine my concern and confusion in 2009 when a change was made for licensed child care programs that required people who have not worked in the program for over 45 days to have a repeat background check before having direct contact with the children again. It would, of course, be prudent for a center to repeat a background study before rehiring an employee with whom a license holder has had no contact with for an extended period of time. But this is a perfect example of how family child care is often a forgotten segment of the child care field and how different the needs of family child care license holders can be from a child care center. We may never use a substitute or an emergency contact, but we most certainly, it's doubtful that we would be using a substitute as often as every month to avoid the repeat background checks. I sincerely appreciate when Jerry Kerber at DHS showed his responsiveness to the unintended implications of that statute when we brought it to his attention. This bill will return family child care to the system that makes sense and has worked flawlessly for family child care for as long as I've known. I ask the committee to approve the bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Any questions for Ms. Thompson? Thank you. You did very well. And it's a scary place to come, but you got to be part of Leap Year on TV, so that's pretty cool. Leap Day. I've been demanded to yield my position now to the proper authority. Good luck, Representative Schoenmaker.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against this piece of legislation? Seeing none, are there any further questions? Mr. Kerber, sorry, I didn't see you there. You can introduce yourself and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm from the Department of Human Services, and I'm in the Inspector General's office there, part of which is the licensing division where we do background studies. And I don't really have anything to say except for to thank Representative Schumacher for adding this amendment that, kind of makes this proposal complete. Just a little background is the reason there had been a requirement in the law for repeat background study on people who have been gone for 45 days is simply to see if they've, while they've been gone from their employment, they've engaged in some kind of behavior that would prohibit them from returning. And what we had in place here was a reliance on the employer to tell us that, you know, probably if somebody's gone from work for some period of time, the employer's probably going to know if they spent some time in jail or not, probably. So employers are required to tell us. But then there's also that section about probation officers and corrections agents that are required to notify us if somebody who is currently affiliated with a licensed program has been convicted of a new crime. This changes, the amendment changes that so that the question asked of that person at the time of conviction was, have you in the last year been affiliated with one of these programs? And so then if the answer is yes, then that notification will be made to our office. So hopefully this should, you know, fill that gap so that 45 days isn't as brutal.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, Mr. Kerber. I'm curious, how long is the background check currently active for once you have one, you're gainfully employed, and you continue employment?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's kind of two different systems in place here, and I think as the previous testifier, Ms. Thompson, mentioned, family child care is a little different than most all the other background studies we do. We do about 1,100 a day, and we're doing them on the people who work in certainly child care centers, as she mentioned, but chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health, hospitals, nursing homes, home health agencies, PCAs. These background studies are good for as long as that person remains affiliated with that employer. And so, again, as I was mentioning, if somebody were to get in some pretty serious trouble, the employer probably would know and then they're obligated to tell us. If it's a family child care setting, those background studies are done under the same law, but they're done by the counties. And so that process is a little different, as she mentioned. It's done, they're repeated at every licensing renewal. So those are done every 2 years. Whereas if you're not in family child care, but some other DHS license program or health department license program or Department of Corrections license program for kids or PCA agency, as long as you stay in place, that background study is going to be good.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you very much. The reason I ask is because of this bill, but also I'm a treasurer of my church, and we have a nursery, and so we've been going through the background checks recently and just curious as to how this relates to that. You mentioned a bunch of different requirements based on whether you're licensed, non-licensed. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're non-licensed, so it'd be a different statute of law.
That, Mr. Chair, Representative, that'd be correct. You may want to pursue licensure, but you're not required.
Probably not. I'm the treasurer, you know. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Kerber. Any final comments from the author?
Please support the bill.
Okay. Members, with that, Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 1985 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill, as amended, is passed. And Representative Schumacher, you are up again with House File 1979.
All right.
Sure. And while we're waiting for that, members, we need to approve the minutes from February 28th, 2012.
Move.
Representative Benson moves the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are passed. Representative Schumacher. I will move House File 1979 be recommended to pass. and be re-referred to the Government Operations and Elections Committee. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There is a DE amendment that I would like to ask that you move at this point so that we can get the bill in order.
Okay. Representative Schumacher has the DE1 amendment. And I will move the DE1 amendment on behalf of Representative Schumacher. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the D1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The amended House File 1979 has been affectionately referred to as the Arm Bill. This is a bipartisan-supported legislation that is crafted for that has been crafted for over a year's worth of work. Beginning as a white paper shared with stakeholders called the Blueprint for Reform, ARM drafted a bill to continue moving the discussion forward, bringing in stakeholders to polish the bill and improve it. The amended bill is a reflection of that work and is the common and is a common agreement that was reached. I was first introduced to ARM's Blueprint for Reform last October. Their goal is to address the concerns of the adult foster care community, providing for more opportunities for consumers to have control. We're all aware of the need for reform in the adult foster care industry. Nationally, 75% of all MA spending is for elderly and disabled, and 25% of all the services are for the elderly and disabled. Federal MA spending increased from $390 billion in 2009 and is projected to be at $736 billion by 2017. At the state level, total MA is projected to grow by 200% between 2001 and 2015, while support for the disabled is expected to grow by two-thirds, or by 252% in that same time. The funding system as it is today is unsustainable. In addition, our medical advances allow people with disabilities the opportunity to live longer. And while this is celebrated, the aging of people with disabilities comes with a greater cost that must be addressed. At the same time, Minnesota currently faces a waiting list of residents that peaks over 4,000 people applying for the DD waiver. One of the most common points that I've heard from my constituents who work in the industry is that the current model for caring for our disabled community can be appropriate for many, but is also a vehicle to overserve. I also hear about barriers such as housing funding and regulations that make consumers feel like their paperwork is more important than they are, and that they are prevented from making their own decisions and housing choices. House File 1979 addresses the challenges to our disabilities community and what they face today in two different areas. It provides more flexibility in breaking down of barriers to create incentives for people who want to choose alternative community services. The bill provides additional flexibility and cost savings by fixing the obstacles found in moving forward with overnight supervision technology, allowing high-functioning consumers who are mainly independent during the day to operate without overnight sleep staff, extending the allowance of five-person adult foster care homes while maintaining the informed consent for those living in a home, and progressing the level of protection decisions to the individual consumer through their risk management plan, which is a step towards vesting more responsibility in the consumer support team. The ARM Bill also breaks down the barriers to creating incentives for consumers to choose alternative community services, including opening the shelter needy funding to facilitate choices with a plan to control their own housing. People who want to move out of the corporate foster care are often stuck because their housing money is tied to the licensed services, not providing for the necessary credit history to achieve greater independent living. Creating an innovative task force is also part of the plan to review ideas from the care providers at the local facilities that conflict with current operations and make recommendations to the commissioner. And by allowing daily billing for independent living services in the CADI and BI waivers to allow for more flexibility in providing services at no extra cost, as it is already done in the DD waiver. This bill also works to balance the life choices with risk. This bill continues that discussion and calls for recommendations to be presented to the legislature next year. This bill is a comprehensive reform that started at the most local level and brought in stakeholders from across the state to find workable solutions that provide for greater flexibility and care options for the disabilities community in Minnesota. And with that, I will ask that Bruce Nelson of ARM, who has been doing a tremendous amount of the legwork to get this bill where it's at today, to continue with the testimony on this bill.
Mr. Nelson, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM, and with me today are Barb Tuner, Chief Operating Officer at ARM, who is our expert on services, Craig Weber, our Chief Fiscal Analyst, and Karen Stockwell, who has chaired our Service Innovations Committee and been a driving force in all this. Before I dig in, I must say I've been with ARM almost 16 and a half years, and this is really complicated stuff. And I'm just so impressed and grateful for Representative Schumacher and the grasp that in a very short period of time, much quicker than I could, of learning about this system and understanding how, you know, what the barriers are and moving forward to, I think, common goals that we all have, and that is to find savings in the corporate foster care model, but also ways that people can move to in their own choices into even more independent living, and that's more cost effective. So thank you for all your work, and we have been talking with a lot of people, people from CCD, the Disability Law Center, the ARC of Minnesota, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Minnesota, with various departments, licensing and continuing care at DHS, and all these folks have contributed to making this bill better. And so I'm very pleased to move forward, and I'll briefly talk about the first section of the bill, which is excuse me, something that came from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It's and is also in Representative Gottwald isn't here right now, but it's part of his bill, House File 2379. And what it does is try to get at elevating the level of supports for people with mental illness in corporate foster care by creating an optional certification process with various criteria that people could choose to get and should help. We're all talking about marketplace here, and that's what our bill is based on, an awful lot of people making choices within a marketplace rather than having something dictated to them. And this should help folks to make choices in the marketplace among providers. So with that, I'll pass it on to which section are we on to? Ms. Turner, and she will talk about a lot of stuff.
Ms. Turner, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Barb Turner with ARM, and I'm going to start with some sections. We're going to do a little tag teaming. So the first section that I'm going to talk about is Section 2. This has to do with respite services and a five-bed allowance in foster care. In 2009, there was legislation passed that allowed for providers to request to do five-bed licenses in adult foster care. One of the things that needed to be done in order to make that happen was amendments to our waiver plan had to be requested, because under the old waiver plans, we couldn't bill for five-bed services. And so that has not yet been completed for the DD waiver nor for the CAC waiver. And so our language asks for an extension of this ability to do request these licenses with an end date of 2016. All of the other criteria would remain in place. So there's consents that need to be obtained. The size of the building has to be appropriate. People have to agree that they want to live in a five-bed setting. So none of that changed. All we're doing within this section on that particular piece is just extending the time period. It's my understanding that the department is making that request as they renew the DD waiver, and then we'll be asking for a waiver amendment for the CAC waiver shortly. The second part of Section 2 has to do with respite. And what we are attempting to do in this section is allow providers to use, for those providers who have a fifth bed option at their home, to use that fifth bed for respite services. And just to clarify, this would be within the context of the current moratorium, so it would not be adding additional beds to the system. It would need to be utilized within whatever the capacity there was as the start of the moratorium. There currently is the ability to use respite services, but there are some limitations that make it not a very useful option for people, and we're trying to find good ways to better use resources. And so what we would like to do is be able to utilize fifth beds for respite, but also have some language that indicates that sometimes we have situations where a person who lives permanently at the home goes home for a weekend. So they're going to be gone for a couple days, and they do that fairly routinely. We're looking at situations where someone could come in for respite, and we wouldn't have to add any additional staff because we would still only be providing services to four people because one of the regulars was gone. And we wouldn't have to have any additional dollars spent. The same numbers of staff could provide services, again, assuming appropriate matches and appropriate provision of whatever the is in the service plan for the individual. So the person would need to have their own bedroom. They wouldn't utilize a bedroom of somebody else. It would have to be their own room. That room might be used for an office space or some other use when they weren't doing respite, but they would have to have their own room. So that's the context of that particular section. And I'm going to pass it over to Karen Stockwell to discuss the Section 3 and 4.
Ms. Stockwell, if you could introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Karen Stockwell, and I'm with Dungarvan, which is a disability provider organization. I am also a member of ARM, and I am chair of the committee that developed a large portion of this language in this bill. I'm specifically going to speak today about Section 3, which is a clarification that we included in this language that identifies the specific type of licensing action that would preclude a provider from getting a variance to provide the alternative overnight supervision with the use of monitoring technology. Specifically, what this does is help define those particular licensing actions. As you know, there are many, many types of licensing actions that can be made for a provider or for specific homes, and this just helps define that language. In Section 4 of this language, we are now adding the requirement for the commissioner to provide a detailed application, including a checklist for what's needed for the approval of the alternative overnight supervision with technology. What this does is it gives the opportunity of the entity or the provider that is applying for the application the clarification and the points and criteria in which they will be measured against as to whether they would get the application or not. We have found that if we have a clear list of the criteria, it saves time both on the provider application and it also saves time on the DHS side in the sense that they would not have to keep coming back to us saying you didn't meet criteria A, B, or C. If we each had that information, this would, I think, expedite the process. It also clarifies that caregivers, not the license holders, who need to document the training received on the technology being used. It also provides us with clarification in the same section about detailed timelines. Unfortunately, in the last year, we've had some difficulty getting an application through DHS as far as the length of time that it's taken. This may have been due to some of the resources at DHS or some of the changing of positions. So we feel that the criteria that I talked about earlier would help expedite the process. But this also identifies how much time DHS has to respond and get back to the applicant with the necessary information, and then how long the applicant has to provide the information back. So it just moves that time period along and is identified for each party what they should be doing regarding that timeline. The last thing that we have included is a revised definition of supervision, which allows the individuals, teams, and the person to identify whether they need the overnight supervision or not. All right, back to me.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Turner.
Yes. Section 5 is a section that actually does a revision to language regarding risk management plans within 245B. This currently applies only to folks on the DD services, and the attempt is to try and make the risk management plan a more useful document. Currently, either by virtue of how the language is written in statute or how it's been interpreted, every single thing that you could possibly think that could possibly, in some point in time, be a possible risk to someone ends up being included in these plans, and they end up being pages and pages of pages of sometimes not very useful information. What we're attempting to do here, and we've worked with the department on this language, so we want to thank the licensing division for their assistance. What we're trying to do is to acknowledge that although you may have some sort of issue, it does not become a vulnerability if you're able to manage that issue. So, for example, if you have an allergy, that is not necessarily a risk if you're able to take your medication and avoid walking near trees or whatever the allergy might be. And so the language just tries to broaden so that we don't have to have so many things identified as possible dangers. It also includes some language that would allow decisions to be made that there might be something that is addressed as a risk, but there's a decision made that we're not going to have a plan, and there would be a description of why there was a decision not to make a plan. Trying to open up the world for people so that there's an ability to make some choices just like everybody else does. So whether or not you have a disability or are on a program, being able to make some of the same decisions everybody else makes in regards to risk within the community. Section 6 has to do with a situation where the federal OIG, Office of Inspector General's Office, did an audit on a couple providers here in Minnesota. And one of the things that our payments are based on is providers are supposed to be providing services based on service plans. So what's documented in a service plan is what a provider should be doing, and that's what you're getting paid for. Those service plans are an expectation of the case manager or the counties to create and to provide to the providers to operate off of. Unfortunately, that does not always happen, and there's a system in place so that providers make a request. When they don't have a service request, they make a request to the county and have to document that. That's basically all the control the provider has. They can just keep asking but may not receive anything. In this situation, there were two providers who were actually issued fines or money requested back from DHS from the provider because the OIG, the federal OIG office, noted that this was an issue, that there weren't ISPs and providers were providing services that weren't in the outdated or non-existent ISPs. So we're just asking that providers not be held accountable for something they don't have control over, which is that information. In Section 7, currently, as you talked about background studies in the previous bill, there's a lot of little niches sometimes in background studies, and currently for people who are providing services in unlicensed services, there a requirement for doing background studies was implemented in 2009. For those people, the requirement continues to be an annual background study. For licensed services, it's you're good with your background study as long as you remain employed with that agency. What we're trying to do is have the same standard for whether it's a licensed program or an unlicensed program with a provider. Again, we work with the department on this language so that an annual background study would not be required as long as the individual did at least 40 hours in a calendar year of licensed services, and that has to do with connecting them to a program with a license, so that the piece that we also included, which was in the previous bill, on the probation officers and correction officers and their reporting, the people are associated with licensed services, kind of works. So it's kind of an ability to get information, and all those pieces are necessary in order to make that happen. Section 9. This is another piece in regards to service plans. What often happens with individual service plans is if they are developed and if we have a copy of a service plan, there are team meetings that are held, sometimes quarterly, at least annually, and decisions are made about changes to services. Again, because providers are only supposed to be doing what's in the service plan, there's often a disconnect because a decision will be made at a meeting to change a program or implement a new program, but a new ISP doesn't come through. So providers put in a dilemma of, should I implement the ISP, which is outdated, and do old services, or should I actually implement what we discussed, which are the current, what people want to have happening. So what we're asking here is that we allow that things that meet the criteria of the way things are put into service plans that are documented as having been discussed and agreed upon by the team, which would include signatures from the people who are at the team, that those things can then be considered addendums to the ISP. So legitimately then after a meeting, once we have that documentation in place, providers could be implementing those changes and have it be in compliance with the service plan. Section 10 has to do with consumer risk and choice. And at ARM and within our provider groups, we talk about the fact that risk is a big issue, and it's kind of like the elephant in the room that we all know it's an issue, but no one really knows how to start addressing it. And what we're trying to do is attempt to allow people choices and risk within whatever might be the comfort level of that individual and the people who best know that person. And the way we're trying to address that within this bill is to delegate two additional duties or tasks to the State Quality Council that is going to be starting their work soon, and those would be to be able to look at and assess what are the things both financially and personally that are holding people back from having optimal choices on services in the community, and then to make some recommendations for changes to the legislature in 2013.
And we're at, before Craig Weber is going to talk about incentives for voluntary closure of corporate foster care homes. One group I failed to mention as we're moving forward with the bill is the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we are now in discussion with them as well as some people in the department. This has always been a work in progress, and in talking to the counties, I think we have our eye on the same prize. But there are some things we still do need to work through with them. I think it's more how to than why do it. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Weaver.
I apologize. Because we got sections renumbered, I have one more section before.
Oh, Ms. Turner.
I'll go back to 11. This is a section on community living settings, and there currently is definition for community living settings. One of the things that we want to do is we feel that there needs to be some plans and some things in place for transition from this kind of corporate foster care system that we have to something that's more expansive and less restrictive and gives people more options. And we think one of those things involves the transition of housing. And so currently community living settings are considered situations where people have the lease in their name, and we want to just include language that says, and additionally situations where the provider might currently control the property, but there's a plan in place for transition within at least 2 years of that lease to that individual. We feel that there are a lot of people who just can't immediately qualify or won't get a landlord to agree to lease to them, so we think a provider can provide a good bridge to that so that they the landlord can get to know the individual, they can find out that they aren't causing problems, that they do pay their rent, and that at maybe in less than 2 years, but no more than 2 years, the lease would transfer over to that individual. So we just would like to have that included when we consider what community settings are look like.
And Mr. Weber, if you could introduce yourself and who you represent and proceed.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Craig Weber. I'm the Chief Fiscal Analyst with ARM. The section I'll be doing is the voluntary closure incentives. Basically, what we're trying to accomplish with this is something similar based on what the state's already done in right-sizing its nursing facility capacity. The state provides incentive payments to close nursing home beds so we can reduce the transition those folks out of nursing facilities and into community-based settings. We're proposing a similar kind of idea here, but for closing group home beds and moving folks out into the community. What would happen is you would have a set aside pool of money, and then providers would come in and apply to the department for an enhanced rate so they can identify specific facilities that would close. They would get an enhanced rate for a certain period of time, 6 months, as the bill specifies, and this would provide an incentive for providers to close those beds and move those folks into the community.
And Ms. Turner.
Section 13, this is a section where we attempt to, again, deal with the issue of housing for people who are transitioning from corporate foster care or people who are just trying to find a place to live. And currently there are some limitations to the use of shelter needy in regards to situations where the provider does both the provider of services and the provider of housing. We're trying to loosen those restrictions, again, to have no limits kind of on the size or the number of units that a person might be operating, but again, within the context that there would have to be a plan for transitioning those leases to the individual. So it would be a short-term transition plan rather than a long-term plan to be a permanent landlord in those situations. Section 14.
Yeah. Section 14.
Mr. Nelson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Came about in a meeting last September that Representative Barrett and a few of you were attended that meeting to go over the conceptual aspects of what you're now seeing today as your bill. Senator Hahn was at that meeting, and it was his suggestion as we talked about innovation and moving forward and where innovation really comes from. It comes from, you know, those folks on the front lines, either providers or lead agencies, counties, and not necessarily from eggheads like us at ARM or DHS, that it's the people actually trying to work the system and make things work for individual people. So what we've put together is a task force that would look at recommendations or ideas from the front lines on how to move forward and do some things that may not be necessarily permitted under current regulations. And there are examples that this does happen today, but it's kind of hit and miss and based on relationships. So this individual group, this task force, would make recommendations to the commissioner whether or not to move forward. And then come back and have it reviewed after a couple years to really free up people to live more independently would be the ultimate goal by and large. One of the key features of this is permission to fail. I think a lot of people are afraid to move forward if it's that you have to have every I dotted and every T crossed before you move ahead. That really inhibits innovation. So some things we think will really work well, and some might not. And so the assurance here is if it doesn't work, you can go back to the services you had before. With that, I'll pass it back to the boss here.
Okay.
Ms. Turner.
Section 15. Within this section, we were trying to deal with the issue of what's a living situation and what are appropriate community-based settings for people who are receiving home community-based waivers. Under the current waiver plan, there are some limitations to the number of people that can live in a living unit in order to get waiver funding. And there's been some maybe unclarity of what is considered a living unit. Is it a whole apartment complex? Is it one apartment within that complex? And so again, working with the department on trying to come up with language that addresses this issue based on what it looks like, not by numbers of people. And so this, the language in this bill talks about people living either in their own home or their family home, living in adult foster care of up to 5 people, assuming the waiver is through. And then community living settings, which already has a definition within statute. We've added some language that says regardless of number of people who live there. And we've also tweaked this section within that current statute because there are some housing funding sources, either state or federal dollars. There are some HUD programs that require people to have a disability in order to receive the funding to live in the building. And so we want to have an exception made. So we are saying we don't want multiplex facilities specifically designated just for a disability, or you have to have a disability to live there, unless there's a requirement by based on the housing funding that's being appropriated to that facility. And so that's kind of what we're doing with that particular section. And in the last section, section 16, what we're requesting is that the commissioner allow for daily rates for ILS services for people on the brain injury and the CADI waiver. Currently, those services, which are very similar to in-home services and the DD waiver, they'd be fairly comparable. Currently, you can only do 15-minute incremental billing, and so this becomes an issue when people are trying to do larger amounts of service for people within their own home. It becomes an administrative challenge to only be able to bill in those 15-minute documented, what did you do every 15-minute kind of increments, and so we're just trying to allow the opening of that daily rate option. So not necessarily that it would cost more, it would just be a more efficient way of doing the documentation.
Okay, anything further in terms of the bill? Otherwise, we do have other testifiers that we will bring forward.
We stand ready for questions and at any moment.
Perfect, thank you. Thank members, you. We do have four more testifiers. We're going to go to finish off the testifiers and then come back to questions, unless there's something more pressing that anyone wants to address at this point. Okay, could we have Ms. Abderholden? If you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. Many of our NAMI members have been really concerned about the quality of care provided in corporate foster care homes. Having worked in every disability area, I can tell you that mental illness is different than working with people with developmental disabilities or other type of physical disabilities. We did a survey and just asked for people's input about, you know, what were your concerns and what were your problems. And people wrote back and said, well, they were worried that staff had a very poor understanding of mental illness, poor medication distribution, condescending treatment, treating people like children. One person said, you know, I suggested the group home staff to have weekly meetings amongst the residents where they could voice their own desires as far as activities they did that they were not signed up for already, and voice concerns and conflicts in the living situation, but nothing was ever done. Another mom wrote back and said, you know, I don't think they have adequate training and education in mental illness and chemical dependency. At a meeting with his workers, the head guy of the care facility called the client's kids. They were also really concerned about crisis management. Residents were being sent for hospitalization when it wasn't needed. They were returned because the hospital said they didn't meet that level of care. Lots of police involvement and subsequent arrests, including a few people who were tased, and staff incapacity to appropriately respond to mental health crises. One mom wrote, staff were intimidated by the manic symptoms and locked herself in the office and called the police. My son was in control of the situation and not the staff, and this was unacceptable. Several years ago, we actually passed for the children's foster care system saying that all the children foster care providers had to have some training on mental illness, knowing that so many of the children going into the system did that. We know that we can't do that in the adult foster care system, but I think there needs to be transparency. Even when we've talked to nurses who are discharging people from the hospital, they have no idea what the staffing is like and what the oversight is like in some of these homes, because there's no way to find out. You might remember last year that in your omnibus bill that you passed, you said that the Department of Human Services would work on saying who really provides integrated dual diagnosis treatment, kind of like the good housekeeping seal of approval, and this is what we want to do here. So it'd be totally optional. We're not requiring anyone to do this, recognizing there are different disabilities and illnesses that are cared for in these homes. But we'd really like to be able to know, families would like to be able to know, nurses who are helping people arrange discharges would like to be able to know that this corporate foster care home, not only do the staff have training on mental illness, including de-escalation and crisis management techniques, but there's actually oversight and supervision by a mental health professional. People with a mental illness in many of the foster care homes, that is not their permanent home. They are discharged from the hospital. They come from the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. They live there for a while, and then they move on, which is why the closure, bed closure issue is kind of hard for us, because if someone is really doing their job and they really have trained staff, people move on because they get better. There is obviously a small percentage of people who may stay in these for the rest of their lives, but many people move on. So, you know, I hope that you'll be able to support this. I just wanted you to understand why we worked with ARM to get this in this. There were some other problems with the bill that ARM worked with us to resolve, and I thank Representative Gottwell for introducing the bill, but I think this is an important step forward so that families can really ensure that their loved one is going to a place that can truly care and meet their needs. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We're going to continue with testifiers, but if you can hang around in case there are questions. Mr. Culpiers? As well as Julie Ring, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Am I close enough here? I'm Julie Ring. I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst from the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'm just going to make a couple of introductory remarks and then share the bulk of my time with our expert on this topic. Of course, counties appreciate the opportunity to speak to some of our concerns that we have with the proposal before you today. As Mr. Nelson mentioned, we're a little bit late to this party. We weren't one of the stakeholder groups that was at the table early on, but we have been engaging with ARM and with Author since the Delete All came out this week. So we're going to lay out a couple concerns we have, but we have committed to working with the Author and with ARM on some of these issues, and we hope we're able to resolve them before the bill makes its way through the committee process. I do want to be clear from the start, though, that we do support the Author and ARM's intention to help find solutions for housing and service options for our clients who are disabled and who are able to live in our communities. We don't oppose this bill. We just have concerns about some of the provisions in the bill. We appreciate that the bill recognizes the need to move from outdated housing policies of 25 or 30 years ago to policies that reflect consumers' current needs and desires and that are consistent statewide and that are consistent with federal policy. We also support the formation of the Innovations Task Force that Mr. Nelson spoke about. We would request that counties have a seat at that table. I think there's one spot for counties now. We would request at least one metro, non-metro, but possibly a couple of seats at that table. And I hope we can work that simple piece out. With that, I'm going to turn the rest of my time over to Mike Culpiers, who will get into some of the more detailed concerns we have in the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Culpiers, if you could introduce yourself, who you represent, and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mike Culpiers. I'm the supervisor for adult foster care licensing from Hennepin County. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak today and provide some feedback and insight on the bill. Likewise, I'd like to echo what Ms. Ring stated in working together in a cooperative environment to meet the results we are all trying to achieve. Overall, I'd like to state that the counties bear the most responsibility in providing adequate services for its most vulnerable citizens. Likewise, counties are responsible for finding appropriate and adequate placements for some of the hardest to place consumers. I view the closure of adult foster care homes in the same light as the downsizing and closing of nursing home facilities. However, in that instance, counties were informed and involved in the nursing home downsizing process. Yet with this proposal, county input, as it stands right now, is virtually non-existent. We can't begin to compare the population that is served in these four-bed homes to those individuals who were being served in nursing homes. Also consider the fact that adult foster care was developed a number of years ago to bring individuals back into the community, moving them out of warehoused facilities such as ICFMRs and state-run institutions. That was a well-planned option and worked extremely well because of the time and supports that were put into place. Because of that, numerous people thrived in their environments and homes. Now, without adequate county involvement, resources, and safety nets in place, counties will lose valuable opportunities for those with high mental health needs, extremely high behaviors, etc. We understand that excellent alternatives are being put into place for those who have the ability to function in more independent environments. However, for those with higher needs, such as individuals like fire starters and extremely mentally ill individuals or those with extremely high behaviors, safety nets are virtually non-existent, and hospital and RTC settings are already overburdened. Adequate alternatives are not in place for those consumers with the highest needs, and social workers struggle at this time to find adequate residential resources. Also, many of these individuals have no other place to turn. They lack family, they lack friends, they lack any other kind of supports to assist in planning or their overall support. Another area I'd like to address at this time is the voluntary closure of adult foster care homes. As the language stands now, counties don't have a lot of input, although I have heard that it's been addressed today, and we really appreciate that. But counties have the potential of losing a lot of valuable residential resources while more marginal service providers remain in place. Counties have the expertise in working with these adult foster care providers, and without our input, decisions would be made without a valuable knowledge base currently in place. Many of our providers that we've worked with over the years have been established, at least in Hennepin County. I can think of some that have been established for 15 or 20 years. We have great knowledge, a great rapport, and great resource in working with those providers. Likewise, I believe it is not a responsible use of dollars to pay providers to close. In some instances, I feel that it is focusing on more marginal, or paying providers for poor performance or those possibly who could be rewarded by providing a sort of buyout. Even with this rate adjustment, the communities as a whole may lose as well. A lot of providers that I've met and talked to over the years have become a very integral part of the communities that they reside in, and the residents have been truly accepted as members of those communities. With many of these communities already being devastated by multiple foreclosures, where does this leave the actual property and the actual house if the provider decides to take the initiative and close their facility, close their home? With that, I'd like you to take into consideration my thoughts and my views, and I thank you for this time.
Thank you. And we have one more testifier, I believe, Ms. Hulbert. If you could come forward and introduce yourself. And then if there is anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill, you can come forward at this time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Alice Hulbert, and I am a parent of a child who is currently living in a group home that I own, and it's being leased to a provider and run as an unlicensed group home. I represent a growing number of families who are concerned about quality of care in group homes and want to work with providers and with the legislature to develop some best practices and some transparency in the way things are done. Here, let me give you a little handout that I have created so that...
If we could have the page...
Thank you.
Get those handouts and distribute.
My head's a little dizzy from all the spinning that's been going on here. I can say I'm opposed to the bill. I guess I'm the only one in the room, but that's okay. This bill is lipstick on a pig, but we'll just start looking at the pig part briefly. I think what we need to look at is quality of care and the bill's ability to strip away licensing from group homes. If you look at the handout, it's quite clear that the amount of money going into this system is substantial. I think the taxpayers of Minnesota are extremely generous in their support of people with disabilities and their support of these systems that have been in place for a long time. And I can understand we need to do something to try to control those costs, but nowhere in this bill are they saying that they're going to give that money back. they want to put in lower quality of care and call it freedom to choose or whatever, but they're not offering to give that money back to the Medicare program or the Medicaid program. I don't see an upside for us as taxpayers. It's going to continue to cost the same. They'll continue to want their $846 per month for room and board, whether it's a house or an apartment or a room in the basement somewhere, because once you get rid of licensing, you start losing control over what the setting should look like. I am a doctor. I've been in healthcare all of my life, and I can say this is healthcare that we're talking about. These are not babysitting facilities. These people have very complicated medical conditions, and they deserve to have some form of licensing guaranteeing a basic level of care for them. We have a lot of cash involved. We have very vulnerable people. I think it's a recipe, if you throw away all of the control, for financial abuse, for physical abuse. I think we have to have some kind of base level out there to protect people and to protect the taxpayers. I can respond to a few of the arguments. I took some notes real quick from some of the issues that they were bringing up. I like the part about how this is going to give people freedom of choice. If that is so, why do they need to keep the plans to what do they call it? Now, they're not using de-licensing as their term, but they're planning to keep it private when they're planning to close a facility. So if this is freedom for people to choose, why do we need to keep that information private while it's being applied for to the state? I think that alone shows a little bit of sneaky approach to things. Anyway, I think the segment where they're bringing in a fifth person for respite services is just a way to bring down another big chunk of money. I'd like to ask, how much do you get per diem for respite services? Would anybody like to tell me? Mm-hmm. I know it's high. It's higher than standard care. So you're going to let providers start bringing in respite people into a house. You don't have to have consent of the people who live there. So it's not exactly a home setting. I don't know that I would like to live in a house where two strangers were coming in per month to live with me for I don't know how long, eating my food and sharing my bathroom. And it's not very respectful to a neighborhood who likes to know their neighbors to have a continual flow of whoever coming in to live next door off and on. So I think that's just an example of a kind of money grab that's being made. And this is within a licensed setting. So I can't imagine what would happen in an unlicensed setting. So those are my thoughts, and I'd love to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you. And we have all of our testifiers nearby, so we'll start going to questions from members. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought of my question a while back, and it's kind of popped up, but it's still relevant. And that is, I wanted to ask Mr. Nelson in particular, or anybody that's been working on this bill, there's a lot of talk about allowing clients to take more risk. And I guess, let me back up a little bit and say, I think there are a lot of good things in this bill. I think that, you know, and I appreciate that a lot of work is being done to try to get our arms around a large and continuing problem. But when we talk about letting clients take more risk, I really wanted to have more discussion of what that means. Because, you know, when somebody takes a risk, it means that if the failure is on them as well as the success. I think that's what it means, I think, in general parlance. So maybe we could talk a little bit more about that.
Ms. Turner or Mr. Nelson? Ms. Turner.
I think what we're trying to do is allow risk within the comfort level of each individual and not have it be standardized based on rules and regulations that say it has to look like this for every single person. So we aren't saying just open the floodgates and have nobody have any monitoring of anything, but we want to allow there to be some reasonableness so that people can say, yes, this could be an issue, but it's important to my family member that they have the opportunity to cross the street without supervision. And there could be the risk that something might happen, but I, as a parent, have decided that that's something that I think is important enough to allow to have happen, rather than to say, because something might happen, whenever somebody is going to cross the street, they must have somebody else there to take their hand and walk them across the street. So it's trying to be reasonable within the limitations or the abilities of each individual person, rather than saying we have a cookie-cutter way of doing it for everybody simply because you're getting services, and you're getting services under a certain set of regulations.
And if I may add to that.
Mr. Nelson, if you want to add to that point.
We're really dealing with risk and choice in two different ways. One, within the risk management plans that Ms. Turner was talking about, but also, as she said earlier, the 900-pound gorilla? It's a big one. That I think everybody in the disability community agrees that as we move forward with enhanced choice of the individual, with any amount of assumed or more choice, there's commensurate or there's some risk that at least some measure of risk that goes along with that, and we've never really figured that out. I think a lot of providers, a lot of in particular, but I'm sure in government as well, are really afraid to move forward when it may be appropriate because of just the fear of liability, and therefore that we struggled with this at ARM and realized that this needs to be a really broad discussion. And that's why we're proposing through the Quality Council to come back next year and try to figure this out. Because people are not going to be able to enjoy the full measure of their choices and freedom as citizens that they have the ability to do unless we can get our arms around the liability issue.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for that. I think this is kind of a core question here. If it has to do with liability, then I guess the answer would be if you take the risk, you can't sue later and say, I shouldn't have been allowed to take this risk. But the bottom line in a lot of these situations is that these are folks who are ultimately the state's responsibility, and if they, for example, and to use your simple example, if they get hit crossing the street, then the state has to take care of the injury that results. It's not entirely their risk. I guess that's one way we could think about this in a lot of ways, but anyway, I appreciate the conversation. The second question I had has to do with the last piece, section 16, the daily rate as opposed to the 15-minute increments. And I'm just a little bit curious about whether that opens things up for a little bit. We just had a whole conversation in the other committee about child care and when you pay a whole day for half a day's use and things like that. So if we're going to go to daily rates, I guess my question would be, how do you define what's a day of service for a daily rate? And don't we, are those things going to be worked out under this?
Yeah. Well, I think what there would be
some Turner.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I think there would need to be some definitions of exactly, and we're looking at more at what is the package of services that the person gets. And there are times with ILS services where people call because all of a sudden they need something and it's not within the hours that someone's providing direct face-to-face time, and can you bill or can't you bill for those sorts of things. That's the kind of the administrative hang-up. So what we'd like to see is for those people who need more intense services, who need significant amounts of services per day, the ability to do a daily rate just allows those services to be bundled, so to speak, so that we don't have to say, and from 9 to 9:10 I did this, and from 9:15 to 9:20, but overall during the course of that day, and the person's in their own home, I was there this amount of time, but I also dealt with this, and I managed that, and I set this appointment, so kind of just being able to handle a package for the person a little bit easier.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I was just curious, there's a discussion in Section 12, Sub 3, and then sort of Sub 2 in regards to the number of beds and the decreasing, and it seems counterintuitive to the likely demographics of the population that there would be, you know, from year to year, a trending decrease. And so I just am trying to understand, and maybe that's something that could be agency or someone could send to the committee, what are the trends, what are some of the characteristics that they're using to determine, so we can understand, because it just doesn't make sense that you would decrease beds if we're going to have an increase in need due to the demographics of the population. Thank you.
I don't know if there's someone from the department here who would like to address that as well. Mr. Weber, if you want to take that to start, and then we can hear
sure.
from the department
Just
as well.
Just a quick, Madam Chair, Representative Quam, what the idea behind the bed closure adjustment is to first of all look at what the capacity of corporate foster care is statewide to make sure we've got the right amount, and subdivision 2 of this, it calls for the commissioner to essentially look at what do we need statewide, determine that first, and then move into the if we have too many beds that based on this report, then that's when the process then starts for closing beds. The idea here is that the services that are provided don't necessarily need to be in corporate foster care. There's going to be services provided somewhere. This is the same idea with nursing homes. Those people are still getting, will still be getting care. They're just getting care on an elderly waiver program in another setting versus in a nursing home. And that's, we're trying to do kind of the same thing here with group homes. We want to look at what the capacity is, what's the right size for that, and then if we have too much, then we're moving folks out into the community where they can be better served.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weber. If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and who you represent.
Sure. My name is Heidi Hamilton from the Department of Human Services. The trends for corporate foster care use have shown that there was increased use, and then you instituted the corporate foster care moratorium in 2009, and since then it's leveled off. As Mr. Weaver mentioned, there's going to be increased number of people accessing the programs or needing to access the programs, and we need to look at less expensive models of service. Corporate foster care is a very expensive model of service, and so I think that the attempt is to figure out ways to incent providers to find less expensive models of service, which would then allow for sustainability of the waiver programs.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would be interested in having data so I could better understand this. I appreciate the intent, but I don't want the incentivization to find alternatives because you're on a waiting list and can't find accessibility. So I don't know if that's an issue or not. I don't have any data to base that off of, and I'd prefer data as opposed to conversation, and would just hope that the committee could get that kind of data. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Ms. Hamilton, to that point?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I can get some information to you on that.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Representative Norton.
Thank you, and I have just a series of, I think, relatively short questions, and I appreciate how difficult it is to carry a bill that has this many components. I did a county mandate reduction bill that had like 13 subdivisions, and I remember what a nightmare it was. And so I'm going to jump around here a little bit, but I'm going to focus right now on the very first section of the bill. And so my first question is, with regard to certification, does the department currently do certification for other types of disabilities, designations now? Or is this something new?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nelson, and then we'll have someone from the department also speak to that.
Mr. Kerber can better answer that than I. Kerber can better answer that than I.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, and Representative Norton, we, as Ms. Abderholden mentioned, we do at the department do some sorts of certifications of some for some programs. I think the example she used was children's residential facilities. So we offer a standard license for a children's residential facility. But if somebody's going to hold themselves out as providing mental health services, they need that certification as a mental health provider. If they're going to hold themselves out as providing chemical dependency treatment, well, then they have to get that certification as a chemical dependency treatment. They might do both. And so we have a number of models like that. And so this would sort of fall within that kind of a structure where we have, there's, you know, roughly 5,000 adult foster care settings, well, fewer now, but, and if anybody under here, this would be a voluntary system. If somebody wanted to hold themselves out as serving adults who have mental health problems, they could, at their option, ask the department for this certification. And then we would monitor that, their compliance with these additional standards. And then that would be a certification on their license, and it would be listed on our licensing lookup, if you've ever looked at our DHS page. And so people making referrals would then be able to make a more informed decision if they're looking for an adult foster care site that's going to probably be better able to meet the needs of this mentally ill person. They could select from those programs.
Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
And I completely understand the intent. What I was asking was, and I think I heard a sorta, is do you currently certify not programs but providers in this way? So I'm a specialist in drug and alcohol abuse. I'm a specialist in mental health. I'm a specialist, and Representative Lohmer and I are working on something very similar with the community for autism.
Yes.
Can we get certifications in other things, or is this kind of something new for this particular population for adult foster care?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, this would be new for this corner of the industry. We do it in other types of programs, as I was giving
right.
the examples, but not in adult foster care.
Okay, so this will
Representative
be...
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be something new, and so... and I'm assuming this will go to finance because there will have to be some sort of certification person. Right now it kind of talks about the commissioner, but I'm assuming if a training is going to happen, someone's going to have to make sure that the courses someone takes are appropriate and on and on. And you may well see something coming forward very soon to add an autism certification because we are working on several other bills actually to do something like that because there is a definite need and desire out there for that community. And that kind of goes to the second question, which I am going to assume then, and maybe it's wrong because autism is a brain disorder, neurological disorder, but it is not going to be considered mental illness. I see Ms. Abderholden shaking her head no, so that I was just looking for clarification that that will not fit this population.
Ms. Abderholden, to Representative Norton's point.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, since you, on the record you can't hear my head, or maybe you can, but... autism doesn't always fall in mental illness. Sometimes it falls in developmental disabilities, and sometimes it falls in mental illness, kind of depending on a whole lot of factors, including, you know, the symptoms and all sorts of things like that. So it's not an automatic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Norton. Or I'm sorry, Mr. Nelson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Norton. What this provision is trying to get at is people who have a primary diagnosis of mental illness. There are a lot of people on the DD waiver with developmental disabilities who have a secondary diagnosis and you know, they have co-existing disabilities, or if mental illness is a disability, that's a good question. But so that's what this is focused on.
And I thank you for that, Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and just to kind of continue with this, if, you know, I don't have an amendment prepared today, but as this bill moves forward, this may be an easier way, rather than having a whole new bill, that we could just slip in the certification for adult and child foster care for that particular population as well. So, Representative, you might hear from us. And the other question I had to do with this, with again, and I know I'm not on the Finance Committee, so I apologize for, you know, butting into their business. But, you know, we have Task Force, and I think again, I'm assuming this will go to finance and we'll figure out how to pay for this later. Am I correct in that? Or you don't have, obviously, a fiscal note yet if this is your first hearing? Because those task force typically have fiscal notes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's been mm-hmm. answered. Thank you. And my last comment would be really regard to the comment that was made by the opponent to the bill, which had to do with another section having to do with respite care. And I appreciate the need for respite care, having worked in the area of disabilities and special ed, you know, off and on throughout my life. But I am a little concerned with the space provided, because this is a way for providers to make extra money, and I understand that there's nothing wrong with making extra money. But as you said, you won't put them in the bedroom of someone who is there more permanently. But it's awkward to have someone in a place who's going to sleep on a couch or on a roll-out bed and not have... I guess I'd be a little more comfortable with this if there was an extra empty room and it was temporarily used for respite, as opposed to finding a rollout bed someplace during that same time, even though I understand you're licensed for the 4 or the 5 and you're only going to have that same amount of number. It's not so much that I'm worried about the management of the person, but where they're managed that I have a little concern with. So if you could address that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Turner.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Our intent, and I think I didn't look fast enough, but I think it does say the person will have their own bedroom, have their own sleeping room, so the intent wasn't to have them sleeping on the couch. Also, I want to address a comment earlier. We did include that there would be consent. That's part of the fifth bed variance to begin with, so you can, if you're going to get the fifth bed to begin with, there's a consent process, and you have to give informed consent, and you can't be forced to leave if you're not in agreement with that. So that's one limitation right there. So all four people who currently live there would have to say, yes, I'm okay with this situation. And then prior to the implementation of the specific respite option, there would be a 60-day notice that it was happening, so there could be discussion, and there would be notification prior to every respite setup, so that people, if they need to, you know, be prepared or you know what's happening. And so the intent is that they would have a room to sleep in, not just a couch or a rollaway. But that room could be used oftentimes in group home situations. There's rooms used for office space, and so we want to have the flexibility that if the respite's only going to be there 2 days a month, we don't have to just close off the room the other 28 days, that we could utilize it for some administrative use or something else when it wasn't being used for respite.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And I appreciate the clarification on that. And I do just, you know, an office, I envision file cabinets and security issues and all that. And so I'm going to assume that somewhere in the development of this that all those issues are being taken into account. And I appreciate your clarification on that. I was envisioning rollout beds and couches, and it just didn't feel very professional to me. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, members, seeing no further questions. Oh, excuse me, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was some discussion from the counties about their role in all of this, and I'm also interested in communication with the cities. Are you, as you roll out this plan, and are you communicating with the cities? Is there any attempt to bring them into the process? Can you talk about that? I know I get a lot of concerns expressed in my cities about, you know, what's happening with group homes, and there seems to be a lack of communication, or is there no role for cities?
Mr. Nelson.
Chair, Representative Peters, we have not reached out to the cities, but we will contact the League of Cities, and their role is they're not like counties. They're not like the safety net. Group homes are located, and apartments or wherever people are going to live are often in cities. We've had discussions around other issues with cities, and in terms of wanting to take a more active role in regulation, and the bumps in the road come, or the kind of a crunching together is in Mr. Kerber's department. There are licensing, you know, for corporate foster care rules and regulations, and part of the problem that begins to emerge at times is, and we want to avoid, is a duplication of the kind of regulation that licensed programs already have under licensing law. So, but we will make that, we will contact the League of Cities and make sure that they're aware of the bill and move forward.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, I believe that most cities really, since they realize that they are very limited in what they can do, but they really would like to have the communication and information about what's happening, and at least so that they know within their own city and their own police departments and their own human resources about how they can be helpful as you begin to even make changes or as you begin to develop new programs. I think it's really important that they know, because otherwise you can run into all kinds of issues, and they are the closest folks here to working effectively with these group homes. So,
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nelson.
Representative Peterson. It was about 3 years ago, I think, we had a number of meetings throughout the summer with the League of Cities. And I think a lot of the issues that were brought up, you know, really important ones, like wanting to make sure that there's adequate police protection or fire response for people who have various vulnerabilities. And Mr. Kerber joined that group, and we, one of our fears was how you notify the city before something happens, because frankly, sometimes people will say, we don't want a group home. And they'll find out about it and start doing that. So there, we did come up with a system that are that forms have been developed, where there will be that kind of information is available to the cities, and especially as the now with the moratorium, it's not so much of an issue, but as development moves ahead, that the cities are aware of that kind of essential information. And so we did have a lot of meetings and reached an agreement, that was about three summers ago, on how to manage that.
And finally,
Representative
Peterson.
Madam Chair, yes. I do remember the meetings, actually, and because I had a bill from my city that just wanted to be able to sign off on knowing even when a group home was coming into their community. Mm-hmm. So not that they have the authority to do anything about it, but just, again, a communication to reassure themselves. And I believe that was the county's responsibility to inform them, not the group home, but maybe it needs to go to the group homes rather than the counties. I don't know. The counties seem to be a little out of the loop sometimes, so and we have the person who knows. Thank you.
Mr. Kerber, and then we can possibly hear briefly from Mr. Kalpiers on that issue as well. Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and members, if I can just address that question from Representative Peterson. What we came up with in that work group that we had over the interim is that the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services committed to this notification process, so that the way it works is that at the moment we issue a new license in a community, we send out a notice to the municipality. And so we keep an updated list of all the municipalities, the cities, and municipalities throughout the state, working with the League of Minnesota Cities. And so that we always provide them with that notice, because one of the things that they brought to our attention was, oftentimes before, they didn't even know that it was a group home until they had a police call or a fire call or something of that nature, and they got there and they said, what the heck is this? And so they wanted to have more of that advanced knowledge so that they then can reach out to this group home and establish a relationship. And to our knowledge, that's been working okay. It doesn't solve all the issues with group homes in neighborhoods, because not all of them are licensed. And so, but at least for those that are licensed, then those municipalities also know then that we are the regulatory agency that they can call with problems. Mm-hmm. Either it's the Department of Human Services or the Department of Health. And that is the fact, even if it's a program that's licensed as foster care, so the counties are doing the monitoring, and we issue the license, we notify the municipality, even though the county does some of that monitoring. So it's really across the board that we do that. So, and I think that part's working out well, at least for those that are within that group.
And Madam Chair,
Representative,
one last question. And you mentioned the unlicensed. What happens if somebody opens up an unlicensed
group home.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, that's a whole different issue than if that ends up being more like a communal living arrangement, and there may not be any regulatory oversight of it. It would be no different than if I wanted to get together with a couple of my friends and rent a house. It's that kind of arrangement that sometimes is labeled a group home. When in fact it's not really a formal group home, but it's people with like characteristics, maybe, and so.
Thank you, Mr. Culpiers. Do you have anything you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I'd just like to pass along what, at least from the perspective of what Hennepin County does, and I believe many of the other metro counties do the same thing, but we have, for lack of a better term, community relations department, and our process, which is called a notice of development process, that works very closely with the cities and communities when we're developing new adult foster care homes. And so we make phone calls, we make connections. If there are issues, we have representatives, which may even include myself or others from within the county, that go out to community meetings and discuss the issues of a new foster home going, a new adult foster home going into that community. So we feel real confident that we cover those bases quite well, along with, as Mr. Kerber stated, with DHS. Obviously, there are always those things that fall through the cracks at times, but I believe for the most part we keep on top of that. And also, I'd like to mention that we have a process that if there's a new development, or if a foster home decides to purchase a new property, we do what's called a proximity search. So we're making sure that we're not having 3, 4, 5 homes on the same block, and trying to be, be wise and guiding the providers, and letting the provider also know who are their neighbors and who else is licensed in that same area. So just to give you an idea.
Can I make a comment? Is the only one here who actually has an unlicensed group home?
Yes, Ms. Hulbert, you can speak to that point briefly, please.
Thank you. There are no restrictions on where I could put a house. My neighbors were mad at me because I put a fence up to make sure nobody ran away. And I get constant complaints because staff park in the streets. But we're a house just like any other house. Mm-hmm. There's no restriction on how close we are to any other group homes or any other restrictions at all.
Thank you, Ms. Hulbert. Seeing no further questions or discussion, members, I will, unless Representative Schumacher, excuse me, if you have any closing comments.
Well, I would just thank the committee and the members. I know when a bill takes half an hour just to explain, it's a bit of a challenge to keep through. This is the first stop in the process. We have a few more committees to go to, including the HHS Finance Committee, to end that. And I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Members, I will renew my motion that House File 1979, as amended, be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill as amendment is passed. And members, with that, I just want to let everyone know, for planning purposes, our next meeting is on Tuesday, March 6th at 2:30, and we do have a very full schedule that day, so please plan on meeting well into the evening. With that, members, we are adjourned.